Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Saka! Oh, il est là! Saka! Oh, il est là! Saka! Bukayo! Bukayo! Saka!
This is Arscast Extra.
Hello and welcome to another Arscast Extra, as always, with James from Gunner Blog. James, a goodly morning to you.
Goodly morning to you too, Andrew.
Yeah.
But wait, should we be saying goodly morning? What about all the Gabby Agbonlahors and the Ashley Youngs of this world? Should we not be adhering to their commands and sort of mutely celebrating an Arsenal victory?
Maybe, but my thought on this is that I hope that the albatross of misery shits in both their mouths. I mean, fuck's sake.
That would be nice.
That would be nice. Goodly morning it is.
Do you know that Ashley Young still denies that happened, by the way?
Despite the video footage of bird shit going in his mouth, he says it didn't happen.
Yes, there are. If you look this up on YouTube, there are interviews, as I did over the weekend, to remind myself of the glorious moment where a bird defecated directly into Ashley Young's mouth from right at the top of a stadium. He denies it happened, and I guess you would, right? It's deeply humiliating.
Well, it's not your fault. You know, sometimes things happen. They say, don't they, that, you know, for a bird pooping on you is supposed to be good luck of some kind. I don't really understand why it is. So, you know, maybe after a bird shit right into his mouth, he won the lottery or he, you know, something good happened to him. Maybe he just doesn't want to share that particular news. I don't know what it is. But a bird definitely did shit in his mouth. I think we can say that with ironclad.
Yeah, it's good that we can clarify that and put that on record.
So, look, it's a goodly morning, but it's also a bon matin because you are in France. Isn't that right?
Mais oui.
Yes.
Having Mais a, oui, I am.
Having
I
mean, a grand old time. Did you get a good kebab? Because I was thinking, you know, of your dinner the other night, and, man, best kebab I ever had in my life was in France, and I've got a hankering for a good kebab, but Dublin isn't the kebab capital of the world. There's some okay places, but none of them really do it for me. So I was thinking, you know, how lucky you were to be somewhere where you could get a good kebab. Did you get a good kebab?
I have. I've eaten well. I've had a kebab that was delicious. I've had bouillabaisse, I think it's pronounced, the sort of dish of the region. Seafoody, soupy thing. I've had a lot of croissants, guys. You know, I don't want to mess up with the formula. I'm in France. No, it's good. I'm in my hotel room at the moment. I was just saying to you off air, I mean, if it was up to you, I think you would have me live in this hotel room because there are no windows, no gardeners. I'm completely insulated from the world. It's got quite fast Wi-Fi. I could just sit in here and podcast indefinitely.
Yeah. I mean, maybe we'll do a GoFundMe or something like that, see what we can do.
Well, we've got the Patreon, do you know what I mean?
That's true, yeah.
If the Patreon has to be diverted to pay for me to live in a hotel in the old port of Marseille for the sake of the podcast, so be it.
Okay, well, look, we'll discuss that afterwards. Clearly, you're hankering for a life change here, but I think this might be done, better off done off air. You know, there's a big decision to be made here. You were in Marseille to watch Big Billy. How'd he get on last night?
Big Billy, well, he has good news this morning. He's been called up to the France national squad. There was some talk about that yesterday, and it has now happened. He turns 21 this week too, so a nice little birthday present for him there. He was good. I mean, they kept a clean sheet. I think he was a little bit fortunate to not give away a penalty at one point. If you remember Diego Forlan going down under Martin Keown's challenge in the penalty box, it was kind of shades of that, really, chasing back into the area and knocking a guy over. He had ups and downs in the game, but clearly a very talented player. Marseille doing very well. Matteo Guendouzi there as well, doing a lot of running around and pointing to some good effect, actually. So, yeah, it was incredible atmosphere. I have to say, I'd never been to a game at the Velodrome, and it was Nice visiting, who are pretty heated rivals, and they're second and third in the table, so it was a big, big game. And mainly thought a flare was sort of going to go off and I was going to explode or burst into flames at any particular moment. Yeah, it was not good for my heart rate, but an electric atmosphere. I'll be writing that up. Yeah, later in the week.
I do like the fact that you've done a Chris Kamara here. You know that? You've done a Chris Kamara, yeah. Because it was...
What's a Chris Kamara?
Well, you know that clip of him where they say, oh, there's been a goal at whatever, and he goes, has there yet?
Oh, yeah.
Has there? It was 2-1 to Marseille, so that's not the cleanest cheat I've ever heard.
Oh, yeah. I should have watched the game, actually.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, fair point.
Yeah,
fair point.
That's okay.
But you know, like I say, in France they all drink wine in the press box. You know, so it's a whole different vibe. You know, that's my excuse.
That's fair enough, and it's a good excuse.
It was very nearly a clean sheet, wasn't it? It was nine. It was stoppage time. They got,
and it was only one goal, so it was only a slightly dirty sheet. It wasn't, you know, disgustingly train spottingly stained the way that some sheets have been. Speaking of clean sheets, Bernd Leno, he kept his pretty clean this weekend. How when you were watching this? Because I'm, you know, we've got a bit of distance now between the game, and when I was watching it, I felt extremely tense. I have to say, extremely tense. I saw one of my neighbors walking past the house as I was doing the live blog, and it was into about like the 85th minute, and it was starting to get a bit nervy, you know. Because of the lead and everything else and what was at stake. And I saw my neighbor walking past the house and I thought, how simple his life is. How quiet and relaxed. He's just going down the road. He's not stressed out to the eyeballs about Arsenal hanging on for the rest of the 90 minutes plus whatever amount of injury time is going to be added on and whatever mad thing we do late in the game that's going to give Aston Villa a chance, which is, you know, inevitable. That is going to happen. I was sure of that. And I was almost jealous of him just being completely unaware of what was happening on the pitch at Villa Park. And then once the final whistle went and I got into the whole celebration aspect of it and the relief and everything else, I sort of forgot over the weekend how tense it was while I was watching it. So does that tally with your experience?
It was quite tense. It was quite tense. I mean, you know, and we very nearly did do some silly things to give them a chance. I've been focused on the positivity and all the good things about the game, but at some point I will have to mention Nicola Pepe's cameo, which it seemed on a one-man mission, really, to cause us some issues. But ultimately we followed the Midlands away formula that has proved so effective for us, you know. Play well in the first half, get in front, seemingly lose our way a bit and look a bit tired in the second half. But then when the going gets tough, bring on Rob Holding. Shut down. Game over.
Listen.
When that man comes on and he makes that five at the back signal with his hands, home fans, you can go home because it's over.
It is over. And look, I'm going to break this out now because I thought this was absolutely brilliant. Scotty Baker, there was a discussion among some of our Arseblog regulars. Scotty Baker was talking about how when Rob Holding comes on, he needs almost like a theme tune because of the impact that he has.
I agree.
To which Brooklyn Gunner, Paul Fritzky, suggested this. So I'm going to play this. I think it fits perfectly. I've done a little edit, so it's a little bit shorter. But imagine this playing as Rob Holding comes onto the pitch. I mean,
I think we should do it.
It's perfect, isn't it? Sam and Dave, hold on. I'm coming. It works on so many levels. It's a great tune. It's got hold and holding. I'm coming to save the day or to shore up the defense, whatever it might be. I mean, you're right. When he's on, that's it. It's game over for the opposition. It's brilliant.
Yeah, he's developing real cult hero status for that role. But it was a bit nervy at the end. But I think that played into and made worthwhile everything we saw after the full-time whistle, which were jubilant scenes, really. And the sort of thing that makes any of those kind of stressful, traumatic memories evaporate.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of why the celebrations are so big, because there is an element of relief. Not only, you know, you've won a big game and we needed 3 points, and we'll talk about that, obviously, because there's so much at stake now. And week on week, the stakes are getting higher and higher and the games are more important. So celebrating a win in those circumstances is just an obvious thing to do. But there's more to it, because you do have that relief, because you are hanging on a bit. I'm not sure if we'd won that game 2-0, 3-0. It would have quite have been, at the final whistle, quite as intense. You know what I mean? Not least because the last moment of the game, the last kick of the game, basically, is a Coutinho free kick, which Bernd Leno makes a good save from, as two Villa players are coming in at the back post as well to maybe try and not home a rebound or whatever it might be. That plus, you know, the relief, plus how big that was as a result overall. I mean, that just explains everything about the way that the celebrations went down.
Yeah, exactly. It all feeds into each other. But, you know, like I say, it just makes that moment of catharsis all the greater. And I guess it lays bare the sort of absurdity of the whole celebration police nonsense, because these points were hard won and were really important. So naturally, we're going to revel in that. But
who will police the celebration police? The age old question.
We will now. The birds of the skies will.
The albatross of misery.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
But yeah, listen. I watched it on my impeccable Wi-Fi in my hotel room, and there was some nervous pacing in those latter stages, but we came through, and that was the important thing.
Right. So let's go back to the start, because Aaron Ramsdale was ruled out with an injury before the game.
Mm-hmm.
Gabriel Martinelli was ill. Now, I think when you've got replacements of the caliber of Bernd Leno as your number two goalkeeper and Emile Smith Rowe, you know, our leading goal scorer, or now joint leading goal scorer, because of what Bukayo Saka did, that's not too shabby at all. But it doesn't leave you with a great deal of depth beyond that. Like, this is already a very, very streamlined squad without much to offer from the bench in the way of attack anyway. So losing Martinelli in particular was a real blow, especially given how well he had played against Liverpool on Wednesday night. But I thought we were great. I thought we were really, really good in that first half, right up until the point where the momentum was taken out of the game by the challenge on Saka. And we'll come to that, I guess, in due course. But away from home, after playing Liverpool on Wednesday night, after being beaten, you know, against the Villa side, who should really have been more up for it than they appeared to be, I thought we were excellent in that opening half an hour, 35 minutes. Some of the football we played was great. And even in the second half, I thought we played good football at times as well. But it was really dominant. And I think I said to you on WhatsApp at some point during the game, like, periods like this it's another way for us to see what we need to do, if you like, because turning that dominance into end product and goals is just so crucial at this level, you know?
Yeah, and Arteta said that after the game, didn't he? Was it this game? I think so. He seems to be saying it quite a lot at the present time, that we have to, when we're in control, get the second and third goal that kill the game. I mean, it's interesting, you know, I was speaking to a Spurs fan the other day and about their perception of Arsenal. He's like, yeah, Arsenal are doing really well. They're picking up a lot of results, but it feels like they often win by one goal. They just edge it, you know, And I can see what they mean there. You know, it is often quite tight in those final stages of the game. And that separation needs to come from us being clinical. But I agree, we started really well. I agree as well. Like, in terms of the players we lost, don't get me wrong, Ramsdale and Martinelli are hugely important. We're missing Tomiyasu as well, still, let's not forget. But if you were picking two players or two positions where maybe we could lose somebody without it dramatically affecting the quality of the starting lineup, I do wonder if it might be those two. Just in terms of the replacements we have available, I mean, Smith Rowe, his ability speaks for itself. And I don't think it should be forgotten that Leno's still a very competent goalkeeper who served us very well for a long time. And I thought we started really well. A lot of speaking of rival fans would have been looking at this game, I think, hoping for us to drop points, especially off the back of the Liverpool match. You know, we've seen after the defeat at United, we've seen after the defeat at City, it took a little bit of time for us to kind of find our feet again, get going. I thought as soon as this game kicked off, we were at it, we were dominant. We were creating chances. There was one for Smith Rowe in the first 5 minutes.
Yeah,
a very good counter after about 10 minutes in where Thomas Partey shot straight at the keeper. 20 minutes or so, Saka and Odegaard combined, and Smith Rowe again. Maybe could have done better. There were really promising moments, but it was the mainly the way in which we asserted ourselves, the way in which we brushed off the defeat against Liverpool that gave me a lot of cause for encouragement.
Yeah, I agree. I think we're learning about this team as the season goes on that they are capable of dealing with adversity. They're capable of compartmentalizing a bad defeat. They're capable of responding when we need to respond. And yeah, you know, there were moments in that first half where I know this is probably a conversation or an observation that is going to be made on every Arsenal podcast between now and the end of the season, but there were moments where if we had more presence and more goal threat up front, we probably would have turned this game much more in our favour. You know, I think Lacazette has done some very good work of late, but I think he really, really struggled in this game. I think he looked tired. There were poor decisions. He couldn't get shots off. I remember one in the first half where the ball came to him and he really should have just taken a touch, turned and shot, and it just didn't happen for him. You know, he's not quite quick enough in the box these days. So you're looking at that and thinking it's a problem, and I think it is a problem, but also you could look at it from the other point of view and say, well, look, when we do get that player or do get those players who can react a bit more quickly, then these are games which may not be quite as traumatic as we head to the 85th minute, 90th minute, 94th minute, and there's a free kick on the corner of our box. You're going, well, maybe they'll get a consolation goal rather than an equaliser, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I think that's fair enough on Lacazette. I think maybe we thought three games in a week would be a stretch for him, and maybe that played into his performance. I mean, the big moment, I thought, came in the second half, as far as he's concerned, with that great move, actually, and a really good pass from Granit Xhaka into him.
It's brilliant, isn't it?
He had Odegaard.
Xhaka pass, yeah.
Yeah, the Xhaka pass is, I mean, it's probably the pass of the game. And obviously he had Odegaard to his right-hand side. I think he even had an option to his left.
Pepe and Smith Rowe inside him. Like, if he was Cesc Fabregas, that ball would have gone reverse into Pepe or Smith Rowe.
But it didn't need to be. He could just be Lacazette and play Odegaard in on the right-hand side, you know.
Yeah.
Took a wrong decision there. So, yeah, it certainly wasn't his day, although, as we may come on to, I think we still probably saw a drop in quality when he came off. But nonetheless, you know, when we did need that breakthrough in the first half, we were able to get it from Bukayo Saka, whose productivity is going from strength to strength at the present time.
Yeah.
And he started the game superbly as well.
He was great. I thought he was really, really good. That combination with Odegaard is fantastic. The goal, I mean, probably not the cleanest hit he'll ever make in his life, but it went through the legs, through a sea of legs or beyond a sea of legs. I think I'd be a bit unhappy if my goalkeeper conceded that, to be honest. I mean, Martinez made a couple of really good saves. There was one where he prevented the own goal, was unbelievable. I mean, great unbelievable save. And I was thinking, oh, shit, here we go. Here we go. This is going to be not just one of those games where the goalkeeper has the performance of his life, but a former Arsenal goalkeeper has the performance of his life. It felt like it was going to set up for that. But look, Saka is, you know, when it comes right down to it, a match winner. That's a match winning goal. I remember, this is not to compare the two players or the two teams or anything like that, but I remember in the, maybe the second double, when Freddie Ljungberg, it must have been the second one. Freddie scored a load of goals in 1-0 wins.
Really, that was 0-2. Yeah, the second double.
So, you know, it's very often games are decided by fine margins, and you need a player who can just be there to make that difference. And he does it. He does it time and time again. While all the time having to deal with opposition players and teams who are trying to fucking boot him up and down the pitch to little or no protection. But he was absolutely great. Scored the goal. Turns out to be the match-winning goal. Huge contribution from him. Huge contribution from him this season as well. Smith Rowe and Saka now in double figures for goals, which is really brilliant for two 20-year-olds, you know? And yeah, look, he was great up until the point where he was hurt in that challenge with Tyrone Mings. Do you want to do that now? Shall we talk about that?
Yeah, I think so. Why not?
How do you view that incident? Because it's one of those where I always feel a little bit like he went for the ball, he got the ball, he caught him on the follow-through. It was nasty. Unintentional, I think. I don't think he meant to catch him or anything like that, but it's one of those where you're trying to weigh up the seriousness of the injury or the pain inflicted on the player versus the lack of intent. Intent isn't really relevant either. You know, you don't have to intend to hurt somebody to do them damage. So what did you think of the decision to give him a yellow card? Would you have been looking for more if it was a different player, for example, who had been fouled there? Like, let's say he'd fouled Cedric. Would we, as Arsenal fans, have been quite as exercised by that challenge? Because the reality is, and we'll talk about this, I think, is that Saka is targeted and he's kicked and he's fouled a lot. So there's an element of us being really protective of him in this incident, I think.
Definitely. And I think we're right to be. And I'm really happy that, you know, Arteta's talking about it, that Saka's taking it upon himself to talk about it, talking to referees, talking in a post-match interview. I thought handled it superbly as well, the way he spoke about it. That particular tackle, I don't think that is a red card for me. It looks bad in the moment because of the speed at which he comes in. Mm. I think he's saved by the fact that he doesn't really leave the ground, as it were. You know, that he essentially comes in very low. I think if he's any higher, he's in massive trouble. For me, the issue is not that one challenge and that being a red card or not. It is the kind of systematic tactical fouling and the degree to which referees are kind of aware of that and able to kind of control, police that.
Yeah.
You know, I think this match was particularly sort of absurd in terms of the officiating, because we saw that example of Granit Xhaka being booked for the totting up of imaginary fouls. I mean, it was Thomas Partey who went around committing a load of fouls in the first half and I thought was going to get booked. It was like Granit had sort of taken the points on his driving licence for him. It was mad. I mean, he'd done nothing wrong and then suddenly he was booked. But then he's Granit Xhaka. And I think I was really disappointed, I have to say, by Steven Gerrard's comments after the game about, I've got 16 screws in my hip. You know, that's, you know, he won't rest until Bukayo's got the same. I mean, I just thought, I thought that was really stupid, to be honest.
No, it is.
A really stupid parallel to draw.
It is stupid. I mean, for people who haven't heard Gerrard's comments, he said, he's a good player, an outstanding talent. I love him, but he can't complain about that side of it. That's football. I'm sitting here now with screws in my hips. I've had about 16 operations. I'm struggling to go to the gym at the moment. That's all on the back of earning a living in English football. He'll learn, and he'll learn quick. I mean, it's just ridiculous that a man who has had 16 operations and has got screws in his hips isn't thinking, how do we prevent that happening to other footballers rather than wearing it as some kind of badge of honor? You know, you're in a position of responsibility as a Premier League manager. You're in charge of the careers of young players of your own. And I listen, I love the physical aspect of football. I love the aggression. I love all of that. It's part
of the game. Do you think it was a red card, by the way, Tyrone Mings?
I think it would have been harsh. I think it would have been harsh. But again, it's because it happened to Saka that I'm a little more upset about it, you know, because it happens to him all the time, and referees and officials don't give him the protection that he needs. But Gerrard, you know, he's got to realize that what happened to him or whatever he endured or suffered because of the way football was or the way that he played the game doesn't mean everybody else has to do it. You know, it's disappointing. It really is. It's disappointing. And then he said, oh, he said we were too rough. Did Arsenal not commit any fouls? And, you know, I think that's... He didn't say that. He didn't say anything about Villa being too rough. He just said that he told the referee that he needs a bit more protection because people are purposefully trying to kick him out of the game or just trying to kick him and not kicking the ball. So I think it's great that he said it. I really, really liked the reaction of the Arsenal players as well. I think McGinn was quite lucky the way that he came over and just barreled into to Lacazette. It was like, you know, that kind of those bubble football games. You see the people wearing these bubbles, like two bubble footballers smashing into each other and one of them going arse over tit. He was quite lucky, but I really like the reaction of the Arsenal players because it tells me that they know it's an issue. And you know, I've seen people say, well, you shouldn't get up in the face of the referee and, you know, you're asking for trouble and all that kind of stuff. But no, you've got to stick up for someone like that when they're hurt, when there's been a bad challenge on them. You can't just sort of stand around meekly and accept that kind of behavior and accept that kind of treatment of your any player, not just Saka, not just because he's young, not just because he's brilliant or anything like that, but any one of your players who is on the receiving end of that kind of treatment, you should stick up for them, you know? So I was really heartened to see that, and I think we can marry some of that reaction on the pitch with some of the other wider stuff, the broader stuff that we're talking about when we think about the team, the connection to the fans, the team spirit, the whatever it is that's going on at Arsenal right now. Look, you don't have to go too far back in time to see no reaction whatsoever from Arsenal players or not enough reaction when fouls similar to that have been committed on their teammates. It's just been, you know, and this is different. This is different. It's part of why we're doing what we're doing right now.
Definitely. I really liked it too. The commentators on my coverage that I was watching, which I think was the British coverage, weren't happy with it, saying those Arsenal players don't need to be there. And I was watching thinking, well, they do.
Yeah,
I'm really delighted that they are. You know, this is about a situation with Saka that, frankly, is not going to go away. I mean, yes, there's a stylistic component in terms of the fact that he's someone who runs at players and so he's going to get fouled. You look at other players who get fouled a lot in this league, the likes of Jack Grealish, Wilfred Zaha. You know, that is a kind of hazard of the job. But second of all, it's because he's so good. He is so good that opposition defences do not know how else to deal with him. And increasingly, we're seeing fullbacks or other players rotating in to foul him just to try and kick him out of the game because they can't live with him. They can't handle him. And the greatest compliment you can give Saka is that by and large, it doesn't work. I think, you know, he clearly was hurt on Saturday and that impeded his performance. But by and large, he's able to brush it off and still do damage, still be brilliant. I would love to think that this would stop or go away. I don't think that's likely. And so I think Arsenal have to do everything in their power to try and make this situation more, I don't know, it's never going to work for them, but to try and control it as much as they can. And that comes down to the conduct of the players on the pitch, putting pressure on the officials, Arteta speaking about it in press conferences, us speaking about it now, it being talked about in the media. you know, it's a perception question. And if it's in the kind of public conversation, the public domain, that Saka requires more protection, then we can hope that might influence the officiating, because it's vital, really, for us that he stays fit, stays healthy,
sure,
and continues to develop like he has been.
Yeah, but for him, just for him as a young player, a 20-year-old with the world at his feet when it comes to football, I know we are highly attuned to this kind of thing as Arsenal fans, because we've lived this. We've lived through that kind of anachronistic dinosaur opinion that Steven Gerrard has about what's rough and tumble and, you know, football, you've got to be aggressive. Sure, you have to be aggressive. But if you create an environment in which, let's say, certain players or certain teams are targeted with aggression that's a bit over the top, you end up with situations like Abu Diaby, like Eduardo, like Aaron Ramsey, all of whom were really badly affected, not just by the injuries, but subsequent problems that they had off those. Diaby and Eduardo in particular. I mean, it's impossible to look at Ramsey and think that somehow the muscular problems aren't in some way connected to the broken leg. Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah, compensation, whatever it might be.
So much trauma, exactly.
Yeah. Diaby had, Jesus, did you see his legs? You know, the end of his career, his knees, the scars, all of it. Eduardo never properly recovered. You know, this was a guy who looked like he could take the Premier League by storm. And eventually, you know, where did he go? Spartak Moscow or somewhere?
Shakhtar, maybe?
Shakhtar, yeah, exactly. You know, so the consequences of an environment in which players can be targeted without sufficient protection from referees, which is exactly what happened to Arsenal during the Wenger years. You know, the Sam Allardyce sort of Arsenal don't like it up a mentality that was pervasive throughout English football was directly connected to those injuries. And it's a shame, actually. It's really a shame, not a shame. It's shameful to hear Steven Gerrard talk the way he talked, because it could be one of his players next. And it's
oh, and if it was Jacob Ramsey or somebody like that, I'm sure it changes tune pretty quickly.
Exactly. And look, people have been pulling out all kinds of screenshots of Gerrard talking when he was manager of Rangers about how Rangers players need more protection from the referees. So there's an element of self-interest. We know this. But there is, I think, a responsibility on people at the top of the game to ensure that the game is played properly, fairly, and you can be aggressive and you can make tackles and you can be physical, but you have to acknowledge that there is a line you cannot cross, and that if a player is routinely being targeted by teams week in, week out, as Saka is, our most fouled player, you know, it's not Steven Gerrard's job to go to bat for Bukayo Saka, but at least acknowledge that this is an issue in football that can have serious repercussions for players and their careers. And when you're 20 years of age and you're already being booted up and down football pitches, you know, to sort of dismiss Saka's own concerns and to twist what he said, which was pretty polite, all things considered. He said, I just told the referee, this is my game, blah, blah, blah. It's fucking pathetic from Gerrard.
Yeah, and actually I have to say I was a bit disturbed by a couple of things I saw on social media. You know, journalists who I follow, who cover Villa, who I really respect and seem to be fairly reasonable people, were kind of tweeting things about, you know, Saka rolling around and spending a lot of time on the ground and making the most of challenges. And I just thought, of course, I appreciate that there's kind of subjectivity and tribalism in all of our perception of the game, even for journalists. But I was kind of shocked by that, because I have to say that's just not how I see it at all. And I think he actually, you know, he's generally pretty good at kind of taking the kickings that he gets without complaint and making not a great fuss of them, not throwing his arms up at the referee, not protesting. And I do wonder as well, there's a bit of a sort of cautionary tale. I think the most fouled player in the Premier League this season is Wilfried Zaha. It tends to be Wilfried Zaha year in, year out. And I do think he has suffered when you look at him a bit in terms of his reputation. I think people have kind of accused him of being someone who's a bit theatrical, who does make the most of stuff. And I think that with that has come a kind of permissiveness about what you can and can't do to him.
I think that's spot on, because I had a look today at the stats, because I was looking at, you know, who are the most foul players in the Premier League. Saka is 58 times he's been fouled for Arsenal this season in the Premier League. Zaha's on 95, something like that. Yeah. You know, which is absurd. And I know, again, that's
and
part
that's
of his game.
That's the course retail. That's where we don't want this to end up. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, like, yeah, yeah. He's just a player you can kick. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And that's where this can end up. And I think it's a difficult balance, because if you start protesting too much, then the referees start just shrugging their shoulders at everything and thinking, you know, so as a club, as a player, he needs to try and find that balance. I have to say, I think for a man who's only 20 years old, he's doing a remarkable job of doing that. And, you know, it's interesting. We mentioned Ramsey, Diaby, Eduardo. The slight distinction is that that was at a time when there was kind of a generalised sense that you could get away with stuff on Arsenal players. Mm. I do feel like in this current team that Saka is being particularly targeted as an individual, which is arguably more dangerous, you know. But like I said, I'd be shocked if it went away. So we just have to keep banging the right drums.
Absolutely.
You know, and hope the message gets across.
I think it did have an impact on the game as well.
It
halted our momentum. And, we did have good passages of play in the second half. The one we already talked about with Lacazette, where, again, it's one of those with more presence, with more goal threat up front, I think we make this game safe and we don't have to white-knuckle our way to the final whistle and the late drama and all that kind of stuff. So
Saka bent one wide. That was a decent effort. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
25, 30 yards. But, you know, it was very different the second half. I mean, Villa, it was interesting, you know, because obviously we had Leno in, not Ramsdale, and you sort of thought, oh, well, is it going to affect the kicking, playing out from the back? But in the first half, you know, what Ramsdale could do sometimes is break the press. Villa just didn't press at all.
No.
So it was kind of no need, you know. You could just give it 5 yards, Gabriel, Ben White, carry it up the pitch for the first 30 yards. They changed that in the second half. They put us under a bit more pressure.
Yeah.
They were markedly better. And I think maybe we saw a bit of fatigue from Arsenal,
sure.
You know.
Yeah.
It had been quite a big week and we played about the most physically demanding team in the league on Wednesday.
Yeah.
And as Mikel Arteta made the point, it was a quick turnaround.
Yeah, I mean, I think we did have players who were tired. I think Lacazette, 3 games in a week, he's tired. Saka, Arteta spoke about fatigue, not just fatigue, but then he's got a hole in his, you know, ankle, which...
Yeah. Probably the fullbacks, you know, it takes a lot out of them.
Yeah.
But what I would say about Arsenal is I thought we defended our penalty box. I mean, obviously, once Rob Holding came on, but even before that, very, very well.
Yeah. I think we need to talk about Gabriel and Ben White. But I've got a question about that, I think. So maybe we'll save that. Just sort of going back to the second half in general, and you referenced the absurd booking of Granit Xhaka. Like, let's be honest. He is the master of picking up ridiculous bookings for things that he does himself, that he can have no excuse for, that you go, what are you doing? And he's had countless yellow cards like that in his Arsenal career. But this one was just nonsense. The referee counting out 1, 2, 3 fouls, and the stat show that he literally made one foul in that first half. And that was the one that he got booked for. And it was a nothing. It was a nothing foul. So, you know, on the
base... Wasn't even a foul, was it? It was for the reaction, I imagine. But
yeah, maybe.
But Buendia had 3 nibbles at him, I think, before. And Xhaka actually went to offer him his hand. Buendia didn't take it. And then he gave him a little playful push. I mean, it was a joke, that decision.
Yeah, but did it worry you? Because it worried me.
Of course.
It worried me because, like, I'm thinking, well, you know, if this referee is that keen to give Granit Xhaka a yellow card that he's actually invented fouls that he didn't make, it is not going to take much for him to give him a second one in the second half. And I have to say, look, we've all had our issues with Granit Xhaka. He has done some daft things in his time. But he really managed that second half very well. I think himself and Thomas Partey were really, really good. I know we weren't as in control or on top in the second half, but I thought both of them were outstanding in that second period. Xhaka, not just because he didn't give the referee even the scintilla of a chance to give him a second yellow card. Like, he managed the situation very well, but he also played very well. I think he provided that great pass, as we talked about, for Lacazette. He was solid alongside Partey. He was a bit deeper this time as well when we needed him to be. So I think that midfield duo deserve a lot of credit. We are going to talk about the central defenders, I think, in part two, because we have a question about that. But those two, I thought, were really good.
Yeah, they're the dads, really, of the team, it feels like, you know. And Thomas Partey, excellent again. Xhaka, I thought, very solid. Some really good defensive contributions. I mean, Partey had some great moments. That pass out to Saka, was it, in the first half, first few minutes of the game, maybe a kind of raking crossfield ball, which was really gorgeous. I thought that they were very good, and they helped us kind of manage the game in the second half. Centre halves, like you mentioned, very effective. I've got in my notes that Ollie Watkins hit the post, but I've gone full Chris Kamara, guys. I don't remember what happened
there. He did. He cut in on his left foot and took a shot which deflected off Kieran Tierney, and it hit the outside of the post and went wide. Yeah, and Bernd Leno was not getting there, I don't think. It was maybe the one moment in our box where we didn't have control, or where we weren't quite as tight defensively as we should have been. But for the most part, I think we were.
Brilliant header from Gabriel, you know.
Yeah. And it's the Gabriel thing. I mean, defensively, I thought he was just brilliant. Really, really almost perfect from a defensive point of view. But you look at the statistics at the end of the game, he passed with like 97% accuracy, made more passes than anybody else on the pitch, any other Arsenal player.
Yeah.
And this is, it's quite interesting when we think about the new deployment of Granit Xhaka playing further forward, because what we have now in our left-footed, left-sided central defender is a player who can do a lot of what Xhaka used to do in that area of the pitch. You know, we used to need Granit Xhaka there to pick the ball up, to be sort of the passing fulcrum, if you like. And Gabriel has done a lot of that, which is why I think we can use Xhaka further forward.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Mm. I think he's trusted with the build-up. I thought next to him, Kieran Tierney had a very solid game as well. His defending in the box, I think, is... you know, in the discussion around Tierney and sort of versus Tavares, or is he the right left back, I think his ability to kind of tuck in and be that almost auxiliary centre-half, that Nacho Monreal capacity to kind of defend narrow, defend the far post, I think he's a bit underrated, actually, in that respect.
Do you think concerns over his form this season have been more about what he's done in the opposition final third rather than his defending? Because teams don't get a lot of joy down that side.
No, that's a good point. And his role has changed. You know, he is, I think, involved slightly less in the attack. I thought he was involved a bit more against Villa, maybe. But you've got to remember as well that when he first came into the side, probably the most eye-catching thing about him was his ability to deliver these peachy crosses out from the left flank. And at the present time, he really hasn't got anybody to aim for with those. So I do wonder if we can get ourselves, you know, a centre forward who can actually compete physically with some of these guys we're facing. I mean, you know, Lacazette is not a good physical match for, you know, Van Dijk or even Mings, the guys we faced this week. If we get someone who can compete with those individuals, maybe we'll see a bit more of that aspect of Tierney's game. But I do think defensively, he's doing very well at the present time, and there have been some critical interventions in the last few matches.
Let's talk about the substitutions then. We already talked about Rob Holding coming on and doing his
and
business
the
to the theme tune. But Nicolas Pepe for Bukayo Saka, I mean, Pepe has talent. There's no two ways about it. He's got talent. What he doesn't have is consistency. And that's why Bukayo Saka plays every week, because he's got talent and consistency. Pepe fluctuates far too wildly between very, very good, as he was when he came on against Wolves, and pretty damn awful, as he was in the game at Villa Park. You know, there were, I saw people tweeting, it might have been Sam Dean who was there and was saying that at one point Arteta was screaming at him to get closer to, I can't remember whichever player it was, down the left-hand side, maybe Ashley Young, maybe he didn't want to go too near him in case a bird shit in his mouth, but... you know, it
splashback.
Exactly. But you know, when a player is coming on who hasn't really played a great deal all season, it's I find it hard to look at their performances and wonder, well, why aren't you doing everything you can in this situation? Maybe you're demotivated because you're not playing, maybe you don't see a future for yourself, maybe that's what it is. But when you come on and your manager, having given you all the instructions that you were gonna get, because sometimes it takes so long to get a substitution on because they're going through the notes, look at the iPad, now this is what you got to do here, and you see the assistant coaches or whoever talking to the sub as they're about to come on, and there's like a list of instructions, this is what we need you to do. And then they come on and they just don't do it. It must be maddening for managers.
Yeah, and this was a particularly bad cameo. Like I say, it was almost like the first couple of things he tried didn't come off, and it just sort of spiraled a bit from that point on. And I guess it culminated in the late concession of the free kick, which was a nerve-wracking moment.
I mean, it was a very dangerous silly position. Challenge, wasn't it?
Yeah, he just kind of hung your leg out, but. I mean, I have a slightly different take on this, and I guess the same would go for Eddie in that, like, I don't particularly have the sense that these are players who aren't engaged or committed or trying. Like, in Pepe's case, for example, after he came on against Wolves was brilliant, all the stories were about, you know, he didn't have to be here. He was at the birth and he wanted to be here. He wanted to help the team. And I believe that, and I buy that, and I'm sure the intention is there. I think it is much more about being able to apply talent and being able to, as you say, offer consistency. And, you know, as bad as this was from Pepe, I guess you almost have to kind of accept it and be like, well, that was the Pepe we got today. And in the next game, you might get the Wolves Pepe again. Yeah. It's just literally, you bring Pepe on, you're pulling the roulette wheel, and anything could happen for better and worse.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with your point about, you know, the intention. I don't think they're just strolling around, although we did have a load of questions about Eddie Nketiah, so maybe I'll save one of those and we can broaden this discussion out in part two.
Yeah, okay.
But it is... you're absolutely right about Pepe. It's either one thing or the other. And it explains completely why he doesn't play on a regular basis.
Yeah, I mean, you know? I watched that cameo and with respect to Pepe, like I watched that cameo and I thought, well, you're never going to be a starter for Mikel Arteta. Like, it's just not going to happen. Like, he is not a player Arteta would trust. And I'm not saying that makes Arteta right, but that is not a marriage made in heaven, is it?
I think he might be right. I think he might be right not to like not to. I mean, if you can't trust the
yeah, the maybe he's right on this one.
I think he might be right. Like I see talent in Pepe, and I've seen some amazing things from him. But the hallmark of his time at the club has been inconsistency. Good one day, bad the next. Good for 15 minutes, bad for 75 minutes. You know, it's just part and parcel of who he is. That's the player that we have, and that's what we're going to have to reckon with. And particularly between now and the end of the season, when we don't have a great deal in reserve from an attacking perspective, we've got to try as much as possible to keep him involved and to try and get the best out of him as and when we do it. But, like, if that late free kick had gone in, like, I think he might have made Pepe walk home, you know, just gone off without him.
can I make a point about Pepe? I suppose we're talking about the Wolves game as this kind of example of what he can contribute.
And
there's a crucial distinction, right? In one game, he comes on with us chasing it. Looking to score goals and win it. And in the other, he comes on with us looking to protect something.
Yeah.
And I think he is much more suited to one of those scenarios than the other. And had Martinelli been available, for example, then I'm not sure he would have been selected in that situation. And maybe it's something to consider, you know, in the transfer market, in the future planning. You know, if Saka, Smith Rowe, Martinelli, if these guys aren't going to play 90 minutes, who's the guy who you can bring on in that situation who can be disciplined, who can keep the shape, who can track his runners? You know, I remember Mourinho at Chelsea used to bring on Salomon Kalou, and he would kind of close the game out, you know, just by being dogged.
Yeah.
Danny Welbeck was great at that for Arsenal at times. You know, you could trust him in that scenario to hold his position, follow his runners. Maybe that's a little bit of a gap.
Yeah.
You know, someone who can play that wide forward role, but in a more disciplined manner.
I think that's a great point. Pepe is a chaser. He's not a closer.
Yeah.
You know.
I mean, even Nuno, you know, or someone a bit more defensively minded might have been an option. But listen, I understand Pepe is the obvious replacement for Saka.
What he might also do, I know we're talking about seeing a game out, but what Pepe can also do is give you a goal on the break as well. So you don't have to hold on as much if you can harness that aspect of his talent, but it's difficult. It's difficult, you know. But look, I don't want to end this particular half on a negative, because I think the win itself and the reaction to the win, coming full circle back to the celebrations at the final whistle, it really did feel like more than just 3 points. It's another example of this team and how it's growing, how it's developing, how it's cultivating the connection between, you know, itself and the fans, the way fans are reacting to results and all of that kind of stuff. Even the Ramsdale Leno thing was a lovely moment. You know, it must have been a very difficult season for Bernd Leno. He's lost his place. You know, he's at an age now, what is he, 30, 31, something like that, where as a goalkeeper, he's a senior player. He's in the peak of his career. He's lost his place after 3 games in which he conceded a lot of goals. But I don't know that you would necessarily say Arsenal's defeats, particularly to Chelsea and Man City, were his fault or anything like that. He was a victim,
great save,
if you like.
Chelsea, if you remember, from Lukaku.
Like, he wasn't great against Brentford for one of the goals, but you know, there was more to it than that. But you know, he's been professional. He was needed. He performed. He pulled off a great save at the end. I think the fact that Ramsdale and himself had that moment of celebration. Ramsdale didn't have to be there. He was injured.
No.
Could have stayed at home, but he wanted to go, support the team, but I think he probably wanted to be there to support Leno as well, as you could see from those pictures. So things like that are really encouraging, because they tell you, you know, what it's like inside the squad. Like, this is not a guy who went on his holidays as his team was winning the FA Cup. You know what I mean?
Yeah, indeed. Or if you look at Manchester United, I mean, there was a player left out of a squad who appeared to hop on a flight to Portugal for the Manchester derby. So
yeah,
it speaks to, and along with things like, you know, Pepe wanting to play that game, you know, Gabriel, I think his partner's sort of on the verge of going into labour, but his commitment is never wavered. He's wanting to play every game for Arsenal. They all want to be part of it. You know, what's Ramsdale going to do? Sit home on his sofa? No, he wants to be there. He wants to... Of course he does. Who wouldn't want to be part of that dressing room, the celebrations, those moments with the fans? I thought it was brilliant when everyone went to Leno and, you know, you saw that camaraderie that exists between the squad, between the goalkeepers, Saka in the crowd, you know, giving his shirt away, the adoration that exists for him. And I think, and the singing of the song for Mikel Arteta as well was a significant moment. There's been a bit of that around at games in the last few weeks. But I guess the fact that this was captured by the cameras quite so clearly and it kind of, you know, took off on social media, that felt significant.
Yeah.
It felt like an acknowledgement of the manager that hasn't really been there for some time. Probably, you know, since we won kind of the
since
FA Cup and the Community
Cup,
Shield.
I've got a question about that. So will we save it for part two?
Okay.
Because we've been going a while.
Let's
do it. Let's take a little break here.
It was 1-0, in the end. I just need to check, because, I mean...
Was it, Jeff? Was it?
Sure.
Yeah, no, it was 1-0. It was a clean sheet, okay, an actual clean sheet.
That was an actual clean sheet.
That was an actual clean sheet. Okay, so just mark that down in your little notebook there for future reference. Yeah?
I will. Thank you.
All right. We'll come back with your questions and more in part two right after this.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arsblog. Welcome back to part two of the Arscast Extra. This is where we answer questions that you send to us on Twitter at GunnarBlog and at ArsBlog, and also on the ArsBlog Discord chat server, which you get access to if you are an ArsBlog member on Patreon. James, you talked about celebrations and people enjoying things, and it's hard not to enjoy this season through the prism of Ian Wright, who seems to be enjoying a lot of it. We had our jingle, didn't we, after the North London Derby.
When it's a great day.
It's a great day. And there was some coverage that he tweeted at halftime, which I'm going to play here. This is sort of coming back from an ad break on whichever Premier League channel he was on. So this is how it went.
Bukayo Saka's strike in the first half. Enough for Arsenal to get all 3 points and return to winning ways, much to the delight of my studio time.
Yay! Yay!
So I did sort of in the enjoyment, in the celebrations of winning, I said I would crank out the jingle machine, see if I could do something with that. So I did, and I might as well play it here now. All right, here we go. Here's another one of these Ian Wright jingly things, which you can do with as you wish.
What I suggest, that was great. What I suggest people do with that is, you know, load it up on an MP3 player, attach it to their car, and just drive around the streets of Birmingham, you know, all around Villa Park, with that on full volume. Seems the only appropriate thing.
Yeah, I think that's fair. All right. We will get on with the questions then. And you I'm going to go first. You referenced it towards the end. A couple of people on the Discord. Stanley says, what do you make of the new Mikel Arteta chant? And are you pleased he's starting to get some recognition from the crowd? And Rob Gunnar says, thoughts on the new Arteta chant and how much do you think it means to him personally?
Well, I think he was pleased. I mean, he deflected it as he would in his press conference and said all the right things as he tends to do. But it must mean something to him.
Sure. You know,
he's not blind or deaf, should we say, to the fact that, you know, it's not always been easy for him at Arsenal. There have been difficult times. And I think as much as we've enjoyed aspects of this season, as a fan base, I think the credit or the affection and the love, we've spoken about this before, has tended to go to the team. You know, the young players, the academy boys, the new signings, more so than Arteta. And I think the fact that it was so kind of wholly and wholesomely towards him on Saturday is really telling, because I think this game and this result felt like proof of something. You know, it was like having lost to Liverpool, maybe we all had that fear that kind of the good form had been a bit of a mirage and that the spell would somehow be broken.
Mm.
And for us to go and win what looked like a tricky fixture on paper, it was kind of like proof of concept, you know. It's kind of like a real commendation of the progress that we've made. And I'm pleased Arteta's getting a bit of love. I think he deserves it at this point. What about you?
I think it's a really interesting development, isn't it? It tells you that there is buy-in, you know, and it's not that people haven't been encouraged by what we've done this season. And the way the team is developing, the way the players are growing together. Like, he's made a lot of unpopular decisions. He really has, you know.
Sure. And made mistakes, too.
Yeah, sure. I mean, he's not been perfect by any means. But I suppose the one thing that, even when things weren't particularly, you know, when we were having some difficult moments, the one thing that I always was able to hang on to was, I believed him when he talked about trying what he wanted to do and what he wanted to try and do, about making the team competitive. It wasn't always easy, perhaps, to see if he was going to be capable of it, but I never questioned his integrity is the wrong word, but I think he was just absolutely straight with everyone from the start, from the time he came and said, there's something missing here. You know, remember that game against Man City before he took over? And I think he was there in the stadium and he referenced it in his first interview that there was something wrong, or that as a club, Arsenal were missing something. And I think he's worked really hard to try and cultivate that between the fans and the team. And part of that, of course, is creating a team that can win football matches, because results are the key driver to all of this. But it's, as you say, a recognition that he is winning people over might be the wrong way of putting it, but it's a recognition that the work he is doing is part of what's making all of this so enjoyable. The players obviously go out in the pitch and they do it, but you have to recognize that Arteta and his coaching staff are preparing this team and organizing this team and, you know, coaching them and getting them ready for these games and have instilled things into this team which were missing, which allow us to go and win games like that at Aston Villa and win games, you know, against Wolves and Leicester of late, and to be slightly more competitive against the big teams. And that's another step that we have to take. But we're in the top four, and it isn't just by accident. And it's not just the players doing it on their own. So if people want to sing about the manager and his part in that, then I think that's absolutely right.
Yeah, and how far we've come from that Manchester City game before Arteta took over, where, you know, that relationship between not just the team, the club more generally, and its supporters felt quite broken at that point.
Yeah,
and you know, the work that's been done to repair that is quite impressive, and it was quite the show of unity at full time there, which I know is always easier when you win.
Yeah,
but
of course.
I genuinely feel that, you know, even when we lost to Liverpool the other day, there was some semblance of that at full time, and a lot of fans stayed in the stadium and really saluted the team. I think we've built something, we're building something that can sustain, you know, the occasional setback.
Can I ask you a question? Do you think that in some way, I mean, we're having a laugh about the celebration police and all that kind of stuff. And you know, sometimes I feel it's a bit like certain celebrity fans who you don't want to give the oxygen of publicity to because they just aren't worth anybody's time or
Oba's never going to shag you, Piers, all right?
So that kind of thing. So you don't want to spend too long on this celebration police thing. But do you think part of it is that the improvement that Arsenal have made this season, like, it's been easy to view us or to view the team or view the club as a bit of a joke at times because of certain things that have happened, and there always seems to be a drama or a soap opera going on at Arsenal. And now all of a sudden, like, Smith Rowe and Saka are not banter. They're fucking deadly serious. Martinelli, Thomas Partey, Gabriel and Ben White, Aaron, you know, there is real, tangible, serious improvement, and part of the reaction from sections of the media or punditry or whatever, or even opposition fans, is like they don't like that. They prefer if we were just the banter club.
I think there's an element of that. I think, you know, people enjoy using Arsenal as a punch bag, and it's difficult to do that at the present time. But I want to give people some credit as well. And increasingly, I'm reading things about, you know, Manchester United need to take a leaf out of Arsenal's book. I do think there are people who are recognising the work, the overhaul, the project that is going on here. And I think we emerged from Saturday and from the recent run generally with a great deal of credit. There are going to always be people who don't like that, who don't want that.
Yeah.
But Sodom, I guess.
Yeah. I think that's probably, you know, the best attitude to have, yeah.
But on the subject of Arteta, though, this was quite an important question on the Discord from Ivanson, or Ivanson, I'm not sure. And they say, "Goodly morning. We have to talk about Arteta's clapping technique. Now that he's doing more clapping after games, it's becoming a real concern." Are you aware of this?
Yes.
Worry?
I mentioned this a while ago, I think. I'm going to see if I can find the tweet that I posted about
reportedly
this.
He claps with his fingers splayed.
Yeah, here it is. I'm going to send you where will I send it? In the chat here, or what's the easiest way? I'll do it in the little chat box here. And I already noticed this. So you can see.
You're ahead of the curve.
Yep.
Essentially.
You can see what I was talking about, what I was referencing, because it's uncanny.
Mikel Arteta's hand clapping technique has been bugging me because it reminded me of something I couldn't quite figure out.
It is. If you've watched Arrested Development, it's there's a running gag in Arrested Development where they all do different noises for the noise of a chicken. I can't remember all of them, but Mikel Arteta's hand clapping technique is Joe Bluth as he's doing his chicken noise, which I can't remember what one it is. Like, no, that's the other one. But anyway, it's uncannily like Joe Bluth from Arrested Development. He does have a very specific thing. I'll put the tweet in the show notes. People can have a look at it and see. But
yeah, listen, I mean, he's doing a lot of good work on the training ground, but a few sessions on clapping technique wouldn't go amiss.
Yeah, I don't know what Mikel Arteta's chicken noise is like. Someone can ask him that at some point, I guess.
Perhaps we'll hear it at some point. I can imagine I can imagine someone asking him that in a press conference and him taking really kindly to that.
Yeah, yeah. He loves those kind of questions.
He loves a bit of fun, yeah. He's just a fun guy. Well, look, we kind of skirted round Eddie Nketiah a bit.
Right.
Did you have some? I've got a few questions about him. Did you have some?
I did. Let me see.
Where's Professor Bananas, who said, "Was Nketiah drunk?" Very low energy, poor touches, tripping over the ball, little determination in the press. We surely need more from him. Joe, who's at Red and White 11.
Yeah.
Good morning, guys. How concerning was Nketiah's lackluster cameo this weekend? It's frustrating to see while trying to hold on to the lead, and it's likely we'll need him again in a similar scenario, possibly against better opposition.
I thought he was poor. Certainly, it's one of those where you look at a guy and you think, it's not so much, for me anyway, where I was concerned, wasn't so much when we were in possession, although I think, you know, there are elements of issues of quality there where he doesn't quite do enough, but out of possession. And I don't know what the balance is between a guy who doesn't look like he's doing enough to close down the opposition defenders and pointless running. You know what I mean? You know, the kind of like run around a bit, lad, that kind of stuff. Like, running for show rather than effective positioning. You know what I mean? Like, anyone can chase
around. Yeah, because I think as fans, we go, you've come on, there's only 10 minutes left or whatever it is, chase everything. But I suspect from a coaching perspective, that's probably not what he's being asked to do.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. But from a fan's perspective, in the last 10 minutes of a game where you're hanging on to a one-goal lead, you're kind of looking at a guy who's barely played this season, who should be able to come on and really, I don't mean just charge around indiscriminately, but maybe put a little bit more pressure on opposition defenders. That's what it felt like to me. And I hold my hands up and say he could be instructed to be to do exactly what he was doing against Villa on Saturday. But from the sofa, with my eyes, it bothered me a little bit, you know, because I just felt like there could have been more from him.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's playing quite badly at the present time.
Yes, that's also true.
There was a decent cameo again against Wolves. Again, a different situation where we're chasing a goal rather than trying to see it out. You know, he had a bad time in the away fixture there when he came on. Doesn't appear massively suited to this job that he's being given in the last 15 minutes of games. You know, I don't think he offers what Lacazette does, essentially, in terms of his ability to, you know, be a bit of a focal point or link the play or drop in. I just don't think that's his game. I think he's having a go at it, but it's not really in his wheelhouse. I think it is. I thought the drop-off in quality from Lacazette and Saka to Pepe and Nketiah on Saturday was pretty stark.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and I think this race for fourth may be won by the team who keeps their first choice 11 fit. You know, if Spurs are going great guns now, but if they lose one of their key players, that would all change. And I think the same is probably true for us. I think we would struggle without one of our main men. I don't think we have the depth. So that fitness issue is pretty imperative, I think.
Yeah, I mean, we had a question here from ArciaGunner89 on Twitter, who says, does our chance of getting in the top four depend heavily on whether Thomas Partey can play, stay fit and play the remaining games? If he's injured, who do you think should replace him at the base? I don't think Sambi is ready to even provide half of what he's been doing. And he says Bukayo Saka, but I don't really see that as an option. I know it's a question specifically about Thomas Partey, but are there other positions where you think if we lose that one player, we're in big, big trouble?
I think Partey might be the main one.
Yeah.
I just don't see an alternative. I mean, Sambi, I don't think Sambi has started a league game. He started one league game since Anfield in November. It's a huge kind of pressure point position in our team that. It's kind of the Santi Cazorla thing, almost, of like, we're going to give you the ball in a really difficult position.
Yeah, you wriggle out of it and make space and make good passes and we'll just, we'll stand here and watch.
You're going to pull a rabbit out of a hat and get us away on the attack. And I think throwing Sambi into that, or indeed Granit Xhaka into that, does not fill you with the same degree of confidence at all.
It would require a change of system probably, or a tweak to the formation.
Maybe, but exactly. The system's been working very well. I guess the answer is, how do you solve it? You'd probably solve it with two players. You'd probably play Xhaka and Lokonga in more of a double pivot and have to slightly reconfigure things. I almost don't want to think about it. You know what I mean?
Because, I know what you mean.
Party's so integral. I think other areas of the squad, we've seen players come in and out. You know, at fullback, we've seen people come in and do well. Wide attack, we've got at least three for two positions. Centre forward, I think, would be interesting if we did lose Lacazette. Would he just go with Nketiah? I'm not sure, you know, on current form. I wonder if he would try something different.
I think he might. I think we might see the Smith-Rowe false nine type thing deployed because, he hasn't done... I mean, you could say he doesn't get a lot of playing time. He's coming on in games, you know, for 10, 15 minutes at a time. It's difficult to make an impact, but really nothing he's done apart from that little show in the Wolves game would make you think, well, if we've got Eddie Nketiah up front for 10 games, everything will be okay. I don't think it would, you know, so.
What would be, is Partey the main one for you too?
I think so, yeah, because he's the hinge in our spine, if you like.
You need those.
Yeah, you do. Yeah, you need, unless you just want to be a straight spine, but you want a bendy, twisty spine.
A degree of flexibility.
Exactly. It's unpredictable if your spine can go in different directions. And he does that. So, yeah, he's just been so good since the new year that he would be...
You know, in Spain, there was that thing, he was called the octopus. And I believe he was called the octopus because he had these kind of legs that could reach in and win balls. But actually, it's much more fitting if you think about an octopus's ability to kind of squeeze through infinitesimally small spaces. That's really the magic trick that he pulls off time after time. Did you have a question about centre-backs?
I did have a question about centre-backs.
Because on the subject of injuries that would concern me, I guess it's worth mentioning those things.
It comes from Henkio on the Discord. He says, morning guys, how high do you rank our defensive partnership in terms of the other top clubs and how good could they become in the future? To be this good at this stage of their careers, where could they be at their prime 27 to 32? And we did talk about them in the first half. I thought they were both superb, but I think it was probably Gabriel's best game for Arsenal, in my recollection anyway. I thought it was his most complete performance as a central defender. The defending, the organisation, the physicality, what he did on the ball, how secure he was. Not quite like a coming-of-age performance, but I thought that was the best I've ever seen from him.
Yeah. I think he was outstanding. I think they're a really strong unit. I think I have to give credit to the team as well. I think part of the reason they look so good is that I think we defend very well as a collective. I think the spacing in the team is really excellent. Like, the distances are all very good. We're very compact. Mm. We protect our back four. That's the thing. Like, we, for a long time, Arsenal were a team that struggled playing a back four because the centre backs looked so exposed. But that's no longer the case.
That's true. You don't see these huge gaps in central midfield with people trying or not trying hard enough to run back towards their own goal as the opposition bear down on our central defenders. You don't really see that anymore.
No, and you know, our pressing numbers, in as far as kind of the stats enable us to see aren't especially high, and people go, well, how do Arsenal keep all these clean sheets without defensive intensity? And I think they do a lot of good work away from the ball, off the ball, in terms of organisation, shape, and that helps. But I do think individually these two are very good. And in terms of how good they are, well, certainly in Arsenal terms, they're in modern times, they're right up there. I mean, I think I saw a stat in 2014, I think Szczesny, Koscielny and Mertesacker were credited with 16 clean sheets in the league. And I don't think Gabriel and White can be far from that.
I saw the clean sheets statistic going around.
I think they must
be on
13, something like that. So got every chance of surpassing that number. In Premier League terms, I've said it so many times, I think these guys could play for the best teams in the league. I really honestly believe that. I think they could play for Man City. I think they could play for Liverpool. I could see both of them at that level, especially when you consider their age, the fact they're still improving, likely to get better.
Yeah.
It's been such a problem position for Arsenal for so long, hasn't it, centre-half? And
yeah,
it really feels like we're getting it right at the present time.
It's another interesting aspect to consider of what Arteta is doing, how he's building the squad, but how he is trying to address certain issues in the team, you know? That there is a strategic element to this. Gabriel was signed, we brought in Ben White. I think he's looked at it and decided you need at least one top-class central defensive partnership to get anywhere in the Premier League. And if you're going to improve, you need that. And as City have shown, you know, their central defenders are not quite interchangeable, but you can work through a season, particularly a season if you have European football, with three central defenders. And that's something hopefully we'll be seeing next season as well. If William Saliba comes back and is part of things, you know, there's plenty of game time to go around. You are going to need to rotate and everything else. But it's about fixing problems that existed. You know, when you're a rookie manager and you're having to depend on someone like Shkodran Mustafi, if that's the best option that you feel you have at times, that says a lot about the squad that you're working with, you know? Mustafi was paid to go away, basically, because we knew, you just can't. And I think it's an interesting thing when we think about what we're going to do in this summer and how we're going to fix other problems in this team. The fact that we've got it so right at central defence is really encouraging.
Yeah. Absolutely. And listen, it didn't come cheap.
No.
We spent serious money, particularly on Ben White. But it was something Arteta felt he had to do. If you look at Pep, if you look at City, the money he spent on defenders, I think it is really important in the Premier League. And in fairness as well, a partnership is not really something that's necessarily predictable. But I do think these guys make each other better. And there's a brilliant balance. So very encouraged by what they're doing. And also I really loved, I think when Lacazette was pushed over, maybe you tweeted this, Ben White just kind of laughing manically, Heath Ledger's Joker. The man's just a crazy nihilist, deriving satisfaction and laughter from the strangest scenarios.
I know, he's so much fun, Ben White. I'm really enjoying him as a footballer, but him as a person as well. There's something very dry about him,
wow.
Yes.
Hot stuff.
He sure is. Big lion tattoos. It's great. And did you notice as well when Bukayo Saka scored the goal, who was first on the scene?
Cedric doesn't miss a beat.
Cedric does not miss a beat. Finds a way. Cedric finds a way to be in the photo first.
Listen, the Cedric redemption arc is something I did not anticipate, and I'm here for it. I'm enjoying it. We get this question most weeks, but I guess after the Clásico, it is probably worth a quick airing. Isaac Nowruzi says on Twitter, Aubameyang posted about separation being good for all parties, and I'm inclined to agree. Do you think it was the right call getting him out, or do you think he could be doing for us what he is doing for Barcelona? A brace for him last night against Madrid.
Yeah, amazing. I mean, he had a similarly good start to his Arsenal career, didn't he? Scored a load of goals very, very quickly.
Yeah.
Look, it's one of those where I don't really think there's any benefit in dwelling on it. Like we said at the time, would you prefer to have an Arsenal squad with a top firing Aubameyang in it than not? And of course you would. And we've discussed Nketiah and we've discussed how short we are up top, but, you know, I think we could drive ourselves mad with this. Maybe he needed the change of scenery as much as anything else. You know, and I'm happy for him to go over there and score goals and do well and be happy again in his football. There was something wrong, wasn't there? There was just something wrong with the last 12 months or so between him, or maybe just what he felt at Arsenal. It wasn't right. It wasn't quite right. And we had reasons and excuses, whatever you want to call them. There was obviously the personal stuff he went through. There was malaria. There was COVID. Yeah. You know, all of these things played into it. A cocktail of stuff which just made it not work. Which isn't to say it couldn't have worked, but the decision was made. He's doing well. We're doing well. Hopefully we've got enough goals in us between now and the end of the season to do what we need to do, and then we address that problem properly in the summer. But beyond that, you know, I can't drive myself crazy by thinking, if only the decision was made. It seems to be working for him, seems to be working for us. And yeah, that's as much as I've got on this. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, I thought Oba sort of nailed it himself, to be honest, when he said on Twitter, sometimes everyone benefits from a separation. Most important is that everyone is happy now. And we had good times that I will not forget. I mean, it's kind of... it's kind of nice in a way. Like, very few Arsenal fans hate or even dislike Oba, I think. You know, he was a very popular guy. And most people I follow or that I know seem pretty happy to see him doing well and enjoying his football again. And I think, you know, it sometimes the separation is the right thing. And I'm not convinced we would have seen this Aubameyang at Arsenal again this season. And I think when you look at his history, you know, he was brilliant for Dortmund for a period of time. And then he wasn't happy there and it was pretty ugly. And then he came to Arsenal and absolutely flourished. Yeah. And similar echoes, certainly, with the move to Barcelona. I think he needed it. I think he probably wanted it or needed it more maybe than he realised. I think it's clearly given him a new lease of life. I'm not sure he would have got that staying in London.
Yeah.
Do I think he's a better striker than Eddie Nketiah? Almost certainly. But I don't think that was the consideration, really, when they made the decision. And for the present time, it feels like everyone's doing all right. So I'm sort of choosing to take that as a positive right now.
All right. We had a question or two about... Adam Morris we didn't have questions about Adam Morris. This is a question from Adam Morris about the subject that I was about to say. He's asked.
That's good, because I'm not that well versed, Adam Morris.
No. My Morris knowledge is quite limited. Adam Morris, at Adam Morris 55, said, interested on your thoughts on Sky's commercial decision to have not yet rearranged the Spurs game, despite ample opportunities to do so, presumably to manufacture an end-of-season blockbuster fourth-place playoff. It can't be right that they can shape the narrative that way. And on the Discord, Benny Blanco said, goodly morning, gents. Given a somewhat resurgent Spurs look to be our biggest rivals for a top four finish, is the prospect of a blockbuster North London derby in May something to be embraced or feared?
Oh, feared.
Feared?
You never want a cup final against Spurs. Do you know what I mean? It's because the stakes are too high. The risk of them being happy just adds too much anxiety to the day. And I mean, listen, it's going to be late in the season. It's going to be either in the final week or I think my hunch and my information is maybe the week before. So we play Everton on the 22nd.
Yeah.
I've got a feeling this game will be on like the 11th.
Let me have a look.
Here. So in the penultimate week of the season. Partly because I don't think TV will risk it going to the final game. If they want to make it competitive, you know, there's a chance if it's the penultimate game of the season, could be.
Do you think they could put it
up one way or the other?
Yeah, that's true.
It's going to be a big old affair, a big old game when it happens. And I've said for a while now, it's Spurs. You know, the rival for this fourth place is Spurs. I think we're seeing that West Ham, the more they progress in Europe, I think the more difficult it's going to be. They've lost Jared Bowen to injury at the present time. Wolves, I don't think will sustain. United, I think, are in too much of a muddle. So, yeah, I think it's between us and Spurs.
Yeah, I mean, look, that's a classic six-pointer, as is the Man United game. And look, we're all hugely encouraged about where we are and our position in the table, but we do have to play Chelsea, we've got to play Spurs, we've got to play United, got to play West Ham. Difficult games. You know, there's a lot to do. There's nothing that we can take for granted. Yeah, exactly. So there's some twists and turns potentially along the way, but, you know, I don't worry about our character or our ability to cope with that kind of pressure. It's just how stretched the squad might become, and if one or two players lose form or if we pick up an injury or two, the depth issue is certainly something that would worry me. But look, one game at a time, that's the mantra.
I mean, if we win all our games, we'll be all right.
Yeah, exactly.
No, but, you know, I mean, I think... we have to just not focus on what other teams are doing and just look at our own games and push on through. I think, you know, we'll be in and around the sort of 70-point mark come the end of the season, which is very decent.
Yeah.
But Unai Emery finished with 70 points in his first season and didn't make the top four. You know, it's not a guarantee.
Yeah, maybe we'll do our predictions because we've got 10 games next. We'll do our predictions next week or something because we do have an interval to contend with. Let's do one more. And I suppose we might as well, given the fact that we've had a big win and we've all enjoyed it, and we want to celebrate, we want to keep the good feelings, the vibes going. Castle on the Discord says, "Hey guys, wondering if you saw the news about Mike Dean retiring at the end of the season, and what's your reaction to that?"
Oh, the celebration police better prepare themselves, I tell you. Because we'll be in the streets if that happens. I mean, terrific news. Delighted by the end of that man's career, should that come to pass. I mean, honestly, overjoyed to see the back of him.
I mean, you won't catch me defending Mike Dean in any way, shape, or form. And like the thing that happened about 12 months ago, 18 months ago, where there was this kind of, this narrative went around, like, look at cuddly old Uncle Mike Dean. Look, he's so zany and eccentric.
The Mike Dean rebrand.
No,
I wasn't having that.
None of that bullshit. Get the fuck out of here. Fuck off and never come back. Would be my reaction to his retirement. Not before time. I mean, I think he stayed on longer than most referees are allowed to stay on, hasn't he?
Yeah. He's 84 years old, isn't he?
Yeah. He's older than Mr. Burns.
No, he's 53. He claims. I just find it. I just put Mike Dean into Google, rather.
Right.
And the first entry that comes up is from the Arsenal website, dailycanon.com. I love that it's the Arsenal websites who are leading kind of news articles saying Mike Dean to retire.
At the end of the season. Yeah, yeah. There should be like fucking party balloon emojis and all kinds of stuff going on.
It's actually really funny because when you click through to Daily Canon, they've got all like... related stories at the bottom, and they're all by Lee Hurley, Lee Hurley's written this story, and then it's got Lee Hurley, Mike Dean's retiring the season. Lee Hurley, 25% of all Mike Dean's matches involve Manchester United or Arsenal. Lee Hurley, Arsenal, Manchester United, and Mike Dean. Lee Hurley, Mike Dean's Arsenal penalty face is season highlight for fans. It feels like Lee Hurley is out here doing the Lord's work, trying to, you know, bring down the reputation of Mike Dean. So hats off, Lee Hurley.
We'll all be glad to see the back of Mike Dean, I think it's fair to say. We'll undoubtedly have some more Mike Dean in our lives between now and the end of the season. I'm sure we will be afflicted with him at some point.
He will not go quietly into the night, will he? He'll be like Mr. Var or something like that, you know? You won't get rid of Mike Dean that easily.
No, no, like a wart.
But at least we won't have to see him.
Well, unless he takes the place of Peter Walton on BT Sport and becomes the new Peter
Andrew,
Walton.
Why would you breathe that into existence?
Are you blaming me if that happens? You're blaming me for that one, are you?
They can't get rid of Peter Walton. He's blockbuster. The man's a television natural. Dean would relish that spotlight, wouldn't he?
I'm sure he would. I guess he would wear, like, funny ties or coloured suits
and
something like that. Imagine he came up wearing a wig.
Just never explain it or reference it. Just turn up with a like blonde wig and be like, hey guys, it's me.
Yeah, it's me, Mike Dean. All right, look, I think we'll leave it there because you've got some work to do on the other side of the English Channel. So thank you to your hotel Wi-Fi for standing up to the rigors of this particular Arscast.
Hey, it held up and the do not disturb sign was effective.
No, yeah, I did hear some people talking in the corridor outside.
Mate, I've had that all weekend. Let's not get into that.
All right. We'll talk about that off air. To you guys for being here and listening, thank you very much as always. We will catch you on the next one. Until then, take it easy. Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.